The World Tomorrow. Ambassador College presents Garner Ted Armstrong, bringing you the plain truth about today's world news and the prophecies of the world tomorrow.
And greetings, friends around the world. This is Garner Ted Armstrong with the good news of the world tomorrow. What is ahead for this year? What will 1967 bring? You know, living with the anxieties, the conflicting reports, the tensions and worries of this modern age can be a pretty trying experience. Now, for centuries, people have made it their business to try to predict the future. Economists, sociologists, historians, theologians, all in turn have had a crack at trying to tell you what's going to occur in the future. And they usually do it by existing trends or by collecting statistics or by studying history in the past and try to tell you what you can expect to occur in the future. Businessmen, of course, must do this. Economists must. Government leaders, to a degree, must try to do it. But isn't it strange how all too often the predictions of most human beings tend to become rather lamentable when looked at in retrospective a few years later? Some of the predictions during World War II about the kind of world you would see after World War II are really almost pathetic. I was going to say laughable, but there's nothing funny about them. Remember the time when you were told in 1944 that by about 47 or 8 you'd have your own Jeep and helicopter and how life would be all in a plastic bubble? When the new plastics came in, and plastics were the rage, and people told us how everything was going to be plastic, and wives were going to have push-button kitchens where the vacuum cleaner would follow her around the room with an electric eye, and so on. All this was predicted just in the years around the corner from the war, and we were going to be living in a world of marvelous peace, prosperity, and plenty. Now, the facts are we've lived in a world of tensions, the Cold War, a world divided against itself politically, ethnically, racially, and religiously. There have been more than 40 wars since the close of hostilities in World War II, and we're faced with wars today and rumors of more. Emerging new nations in Africa, throwing off the yoke of colonialism, have meant monstrous headaches and problems for themselves as well as the rest of the world. And isn't it strange how almost anywhere a problem erupts today, you can almost gamble, if you are a gambling man, that it's going to become the personal property of the United States of America. Or Great Britain, in that order, generally. And between the two of us, we seem to inherit the problems of all the rest of the world almost automatically. Isn't that strange? And then you look at the world in retrospect, looking back at the weather for the past decade, and you find, if you'll check some of the almanacs, we've lived in a time of such fantastic upsets in weather that it has been literally unchronicled in the past. Nothing like it in all of history. The last decade has been the worst in all of record-keeping. For earthquakes, tropical storms, typhoons, hurricanes, smashing into the Gulf Coast of the United States and other areas around the world, thousands have died in Burma, India, Japan, Indonesia, the Philippines, all around the world. Now, isn't it also strange when you find that there was one prediction that stands out among all of them and is the oldest of all of them? That goes way, way back in history, way before World War II, or even before the Industrial Revolution or the Renaissance, for that matter, that foretold a time not of peace and plenty and prosperity following World War II, but foretold of wars and rumors of wars, of a tremendous fervor and return to religion and a trend toward unification of the vast religions of the world, unifying religions, of a trend toward emerging new power blocks, of upsets in the weather and unusual earthquake activity all over. At the same time, drought and famine, a lack of food, and food production, in other words, not keeping pace with the population explosion. Now, Secretary General U Thant gave a rather gloomy prediction when he said he wasn't too happy with what he saw in the future. He said the world as a whole does not seem ready to turn over a new leaf. Well, that's right. There's a sort of a tongue-in-cheek joke about how quickly people break their New Year's resolutions. And I think the people take comfort in that. I think they like to feel a little bit of togetherness in it. They like to make a couple of New Year's resolutions and then break them as quickly as possible and laugh about it. It's actually a travesty, isn't it, that people say, may you have happiness and peace and plenty and prosperity and merriness and joy. And actually, sort of behind the scenes, we all have this nagging fear we're going to have exactly the opposite.
We're going to have a year fraught with tensions and headaches, with international problems and upset weather, with continuing drought and famine, with mounting crime and rising divorce, with worsening juvenile delinquency, and almost every sociological problem we face today is going to get bigger and bigger, more worrisome and more burdensome, and yet we like to hide our eyes from the facts. Well, as I said, there is one prophecy that stands out among all the others. And that prophecy was exactly accurate. People might have called this prophet, this prognosticator, this news analyst, a real doomsday prophet. Because while he did talk about the emergence of a new age, a new era, a fantastic time of productivity, and when he talked about narrowing the disparity between nations and solving the racial tensions and even solving the weather problems and having to do with the religions of the world, and even the language difficulties of the world, vast agrarian and economic reform, all of these things went into what he predicted. Still, they would have accused him of being a doomsday prophet, of saying that he was a pessimist of some kind. He expected everything to get bad and worse. His name was Jesus Christ of Nazareth. He said, whether you've read it or not, in this most important prophecy of all the Bible I've been talking about, the Olivet prophecy in Matthew 24, that we would be living in this precise moment, and I'll tell you in a moment how he dated it, in a time of wars and rumors of wars, of increased religious activity, and yet people, while they believe in this or that or the other theological idea, and that's impossible, mankind from the face of the earth. It's never been possible until this time, the last decade or so. It would have staggered you to have been told in 1887 or so, that there were weapons extant which could obliterate all of humankind. You simply could not envision this in any of the most, well, in animalistic or bestial wars of attrition that man could ever start would finally end with one enemy practically annihilating another, and because of the economy and everything else, it would finally have had to cease. And even though you had a tenth of them left, you couldn't have imagined any normal war that would have resulted in the complete annihilation of all mankind. It was inconceivable. And yet today it is no longer inconceivable. It is a continuing possibility. And it colors everything we say, think, and do, as former President Kennedy said. It's with us all the time. It's that nagging worry, that big cloud that hangs over us all the time. The possibility of the extinction of the human race. Now, Jesus Christ of Nazareth predicted all of this occurring at the same time centuries ago in actual detail. You may not have known the Bible is one-third prophecy and that Jesus Christ was a news analyst, that he forecast the news of this precise moment in history. But if you don't know it, it's because you may not have looked into it for yourself. Now, I've been asking, how can you prove prophecies of the future are true? Unless you go back and find out whether you can substantiate prophecies of the past. Can you look into the Bible and find there were definite, specific predictions made of cities, city-states, kings, nations, ethnic groups, and that they came to pass exactly on schedule, as the prophets said they would? We've got a booklet for you that does exactly this, that shows you, first of all, from the Bible, and then the corroborative points and proofs from history, of how many prophecies of the past did come to occur exactly on schedule, just as God, through these prophets, said they would. Now, before you make up your mind, write in for that booklet and look into it for yourself. It's entitled The Proof of the Bible. And write in for the booklet entitled Does God Exist at the same time? Now, if you already have that booklet, then so much the better. You need to write in also then for the articles on prophecy. Why prophecy? And the United States and the British Commonwealth in prophecy. Now, along that line, let me again remark on this booklet on earthquakes, because that's one of the major prophecies Jesus mentioned in Matthew 24, that you would be living in a time of increased earthquake activity and in strange and unusual places. And this booklet on earthquake, completely and thoroughly documented with the latest statistical evidence from seismologists around the world, and remember, one of the major points of seismology is right here in Pasadena, California, the California Institute of Technology, or Caltech as we call it, where Dr. Richter himself is, and of course, more earthquakes are coming. That's what seismologists say, and they're preparing for one of the worst in all of history. I say preparing, they're at least expecting it and worrying about it. That's about all the preparation you can do, after all, in California. But here is what is prophesied about future earthquakes and the likelihood of them where you live, whether it's England or Australia or South Africa or in the Philippines. What is the likelihood of earthquakes occurring in your area of the world? Here is what the geophysical year unearthed about that ring of fire, these giant fault lines that go across continents and underneath the beds of the ocean around the world, the stresses and strains building up within the crust of this earth. It's all quite scientifically documented, yet it's in layman's language. There is no technical or difficult to understand thing in the book at all, but also it shows you what the Bible says about future earthquakes. So it's free of charge. There is no price for it. Be sure to write in to the address which I will give you at the close of this program. Well, now remember that one of the biggest movements afoot today is the one which seeks to discredit Bible prophecy and Christ himself. People say, if there is a God, prove it. They say, why doesn't God come down and talk to us? And it's actually very, very old-fashioned in anything but modern to believe in God. It's far more modern today to believe in nothing. And the less in which you believe, the more popular and modern you can become. As a matter of fact, that is the very meaning of the term agnostic. An agnostic is one who believes in nothing, really, because he claims to suspend judgment. He says that there are insufficient facts with which to make a decision, and so he suspends judgment. Yet all agnostics, you'll have to agree, generally lean, while they claim to be completely objective, they generally lean toward the negative side of the fence. They will attack the idea of God a lot more than they will attack the idea of no God. In other words, they are not objective. They like to use the term agnostic or skeptic or something. Then atheists are a stranger people. They are people who claim they have proved there is no God. And of course, this is untrue because no such proof exists. And some of the ideas that come up about the God versus no God idea, or whether or not Christ lived, and whether or not he died, and whether or not he rose again. Well, if it weren't so serious, if it weren't on such a tremendous subject that has to do with your future, it would be almost laughable. But of course, it isn't laughable, it's quite serious. Now, today, there is quite a movement afoot to discredit the resurrection of Jesus Christ of Nazareth. Of course, if people or proponents of belief could change anything, then we would be in a different world entirely, wouldn't we? So preponderance of opinion never changes anything, but people say if there is a God, prove it. And they say they feel now that Jesus Christ was given some kind of a drug when the sponge was handed him on the stake or the cross, and that this merely doped him in such a way they couldn't measure or find any pulse, and that he lay there and then came to a little later, but the plan backfired on him, as one story has it, and he died from suffocation or maybe bleeding to death from his wounds, and then was secreted away and buried someplace else. Others claim that he himself came out of the tomb and either sneaked away or else his disciples secreted his body away, or maybe his enemies got it, either the Roman soldiers or the Jewish people of that day way back then centuries ago. And none of these ideas will bear up under the light of simple objective reasoning based upon the Bible only as a purely historical document and not as being inspired at all, for that matter. Now, remember one thing, that while there is a great movement afoot to discredit the Bible, they don't need to be all that vehement in it, because from time immemorial, even those people who have claimed to accept the Bible have not had any great feeling that they ought to obey it. I mean, it does make you wonder, since most who claim to believe in Christ in the past reason round you don't have to obey him anyway. So you wonder, what is all the furor about? Because hundreds of thousands of people, while professing Christians, and while they might feel they themselves personally are being attacked if someone attacks the Bible, yet if you turn right around and say, well, now listen, here you are supporting and upholding the Bible, well, why don't you obey it? Well, that gets pretty close to home, and so they begin to tell you why they don't obey the Bible. Why they feel that while the Bible is basically good, and they think there is a God, yet that God has been created in their own image, and they accept only those portions of the Bible which appeal to them, and they will take the Bible, so to speak, with a grain of salt. Like I mentioned, the program I heard not so long ago where a fellow backed another guy into the corner because he said, now look, how do you explain by any physical circumstances, as if it's psychosomatic or there's some magic connected with it, the resurrection of Lazarus? And of course, the fellow had no answer. But then a little later, this same person who used the resurrection of Lazarus as a proof positive that there may be something spiritual to the idea of the resurrection of a person from the grave, from the dead, turned right around and said, "You don't mean to tell me you believe in that old story about Adam and Eve in a garden, do you?" Now, isn't it amazing how today people will gasp with amazement if science claims it can almost create life? Why, science can do it. Science has almost unlocked the key to the beginning origins of life, they say. And people look upon this with a great amount of pride. They accept that statement automatically, and there is no real great movement afoot against it. But that's tantamount to saying science can create, isn't it? In other words, science is God. But of course, you see, science doesn't tell you how to live and doesn't claim to, so there's no problem. Science doesn't lay down a set of orders and rules. It's like it was said that science can give us the engines and the weapons and the means to destroy ourselves from the face of the earth. It can give us these fantastic destructive methods and explosive forces, but it can't tell us how to control them. And this is a point that people like to bring out about science. While science can apparently discover and produce and measure and weigh, and that is wherever they can measure and weigh, they can be quite safe. Where they can't, that's something else again. But science does not tell you how to live, what to do, or that it is going to in some way judge you in the future. Now, there is someone speaking in a book called The Bible who claims to do this, who says he can create, but also says he sets down a way of life, ethics, mores, laws, principles, regulations, standards, orders, that he gives you commands, and he says you either live by those commands or else you're going to reap a lot of wrong results. And you're going to find out you're going contrary to existing laws and principles that will wallop you even if you're unaware of them. This makes people mad. I've been explaining in the New Testament, principally in the writings of the Apostle Paul, of how the Bible itself predicted it would be this way. The Bible predicted the attitude of people toward the Bible. That's all there too. The Bible leaves nothing out. There's nothing given to caprice or chance in the Bible. It says that the carnal mind would be enmity against the laws of God, would not be subject to the laws of God, neither indeed could be. It isn't in the average person to look toward the Bible as having a great authority over his life or his being. And I'm not going to convince anybody of that just by talking about it, and I well know that. I've been given a commission to cry aloud and spare not and show some people their sins and mistakes and to preach the good news of that coming future world the way it is going to be, not because any human beings are going to vote it in, but because it will be brought for us and to us. But in the meantime, what about that one most important event in all of history that is coming in for such criticism today? The resurrection. Did it occur? Did Jesus Christ of Nazareth walk the earth? Did he die? Was he literally dead? Did he rise again? Do you really believe that? Or if you disbelieve it, why do you disbelieve it? Have you proved it to yourself one way or the other? These are major questions. Look at the Western world of Christianity with its major holidays, which have directed and shaped the very course of your life and many of your holidays and your visits and your vacations, your reunion with friends and relatives have had to do with these major holidays of the so-called Christian world. Easter, for example, which commemorates, supposedly, the resurrection of Jesus Christ of Nazareth from the grave. Now here we are in the modern space age, the mid-60s A.D. And while there is a great intellectual hue and cry, if there's a God, prove it, and Christ is dead, and all this kind of thing, yet here we are in a world which has been so affected by the Christian religion, by at least vague or general belief in the resurrection of Jesus Christ. Have you ever proved or disproved that major event to yourself? It is, of all things, most unintellectual, most unscholarly, to even remotely begin to assume his enemies stole his body, or that his friends secreted it away and reburied it elsewhere. These cannot, in any manner, shape, or form, hold water. It doesn't make sense. As I've said before, if his enemies had stolen the body, they would have displayed it. If his friends, they would not have gone out and died and been murdered in every brutal form, crucified upside down, burned at the stake, run through with swords and impaled for what they knew to be a fraud. And remember, these letters, these books of the Bible were written beginning at about 50 A.D. John wasn't written until later. Matthew, maybe about the same time as 1 Thessalonians, about 50 A.D. Now, Jesus was crucified in 31. So remember, their faith did not rest on what somebody had written before the event. It rested on something they had seen with their own eyes. It rested on their own experience, not on what somebody said. There was no tampering with the records. The records hadn't been recorded yet. You can't begin to believe from any manner, shape, or form of reasoning that Jesus Christ did not rise from the dead if you take the Bible account at face value, even as an uninspired historical document. The Bible is unusual. It's not uninspired, and it's not just an historical document. But, of course, this is something you need to get busy and prove to yourself and quit letting other people do your thinking and your opinion-making for you. But the Bible, unlike books of this modern age, shows the weaknesses of its so-called heroes. It also shows the strength of character of its wrongdoers and evil people. It is completely and totally objective. It shows you here how these disciples, the very closest ones to Jesus Christ and his own mother, did not expect him to be resurrected, didn't want to believe it, had to have this great fact proved to them over and over again by the most scientific of all methods, which, after all, is with your own eyes, seeing, touching, feeling, measuring, weighing, and experience, and that's pragmatism at its highest, isn't it? They had to have it absolutely proved to them, and they wouldn't accept it without that proof. Now, they were quite slow to believe in the resurrection of Christ. And here in the 20th chapter of the book of John, you begin to read of his mother, who came and then didn't believe he had been resurrected. And her question, repeated twice, was, well, where have they taken his body? She wanted to go to find where the body had been removed to. The 3 days and three nights had passed. He had said himself, as the one major perennial proof he was going to leave that he was the Messiah and the Son of God, that he would be 3 days and three nights in the tomb. Try counting that on your fingers between Friday sunset and Sunday morning, incidentally. He would be exactly 72 hours in the tomb, and then he was going to rise again. He said it time and time again. His disciples said, oh, sure. And they listened, and then they went off and believed whatever they wanted to. Now you begin to find that they were not expecting it, even though Jesus had repeatedly and plainly and forcefully, and you can quote scripture after scripture, Matthew 16:21, Matthew 17:9, and verse 23, Matthew 20, and verse 19, Mark 8:31, Luke 24:7, on and on, that he was going to rise again, as he said. But, you know, they didn't understand a lot of what Christ said, even some of the simplest parables. They said, what do you mean by that? And so they must have thought, well, this was some kind of a play on words. It was a story of some kind, just another one of these things that Jesus had a habit of saying that they didn't get, so they smiled, they loved him for it, but they didn't understand it. And so, of course, when Jesus walked out of that tomb, they didn't believe it. John alone, of all the disciples who came and saw, believed when he saw that someone, apparently, had removed the body. He didn't know what had happened exactly, but he began to believe, it says. Mary Magdalene had only one thought, that somebody else must have taken the body. The report of the women that Jesus had risen after he appeared to them, and the women told the disciples, they looked upon it as idle talk, if you'll read Luke 24 and verse 11. And then remember how even after he'd appeared to them, Peter said in the 21st chapter of the book of John, and in verse 3, I go a-fishing. I'm going to go fishing. I think it's all over. And so, of course, immediately, why, the rest of them said, well, we might as well go with you. So they all went. They put off, and they were out there busily at their industry again, earning their living by fishing. They weren't doing so well that day, though. They didn't know exactly why, but they couldn't catch a fish to save them. And somebody appeared on the shore, and they didn't know who it was. You find in verse 4, and he said, have you got anything to eat? And they said, no. They shouted across the little narrow gap that separated them from the shore. And he said, well, why don't you put your net down on the other side? So they threw it over there right quick, and they were open for suggestions. Any fisherman is, have been sitting out there all day long without anything in the net, you know. So they put it on the other side of the boat, and they liked to broke the net, it says, with fish. They took another look over there, and Peter recognized who it was, and Peter, as impetuous as he was, threw himself into the sea and swam all the way to shore and found Christ over there getting a fire started. Now, the Apostle Paul said he appeared to more than 500 brethren on one occasion, and this took place over a month and 10 days. It went on and on and on. It wasn't a couple of mysterious appearances standing above a rock someplace. It wasn't speaking from a cloud. It wasn't a few mysterious occurrences no one could document. They ate meals with him. He built fires in front of them. He appeared in their midst behind closed doors, and they didn't want to believe it. Thomas was a pretty hard-headed fellow. He was quite scientific. He said, I won't believe it unless I see the scars. And Christ said, put your hand in my side and don't doubt anymore. Begin to believe, Thomas. There is no conceivable way to account for the origin of that tremendous event except fact. And you can reason yourself into all kinds of hallucinations all day long, and you can't change it. But you can prove it, if you're not afraid of what you might find out. If you're not afraid, you might discover that Jesus Christ of Nazareth is alive at this precise moment and might have a say-so over your life and your future. Now, if you're not afraid to discover the truth, if you're not afraid to discover the Bible is a book that carries weight and that has absolute authority over your life and to which you owe allegiance and that you ought to be obeying in your own life, then write for these booklets on the resurrection and the crucifixion and the one on the proof of the Bible and does God exist, and find out for yourself. Get it cleared up. Quit letting other people make your ideas and opinions up for you. You've got an opinion about the Bible. You say, well, I don't know. I think this or that about the Bible. How much have you read it? The average church-going professing Christian can't tell you the first four books of it in order. Got a letter from a man the other day who said he heard me say that, and he thought, well, now wait just a minute. I can, and so he started. And he couldn't. Can you? What are they? Right quick. Da-di-da-di-da. Can you name them? You know where the book of Hezekiah is found? New or the Old Testament? That might be a good one for you to research. Why don't you check up for yourself and find out for yourself by writing for these booklets? They're free of charge. Does God exist? The proof of the Bible, the resurrection, the crucifixion. Be sure to write for our booklet on the wonderful world tomorrow, What It Will Be Like, that shows you the exact conditions that will occur on this earth within your lifetime and mine. The way the world will be tomorrow. The good news, it is not being reported today. The good news beyond today's bad news. The solution to the big problems that people worry about. How the land is even going to become more productive. The solution to the economic problems and the race problems and the political problems of the world. How total disarmament will finally be achieved. This booklet is full color, graphically illustrated, even depicting conditions the way they can be and the way they will be. The wonderful world tomorrow, what will it be like? It first of all shows you the absolute hopelessness of the predictions you're hearing from government leaders today. And then it shows you the best news you could ever read, a graphically illustrated master plan mapping out the course of this world the way it is going to be, in spite of anything mankind does to the contrary. This booklet, The Wonderful World Tomorrow, what will it be like? You need to read it. It's absolutely free of charge. There are no strings attached. No one's going to call on you. There is no cost. If you write to us immediately, we'll send it by return mail free of charge. All you need to do is to address your letter to Herbert W. Armstrong, Box 111, Pasadena, California. That's Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California. Be sure to tell us the call letters of your station. Until next time, this is Garner Ted Armstrong saying goodbye, friends.
You have heard The World Tomorrow. Send your letters to Herbert W. Armstrong, Post Office Box 111, Pasadena, California.